Welcome to another False Flag Weekly News. I'm Kevin Barrett with our special co-host, Anthony Hall. He's back. Tony is back on False Flag Weekly News as of last week and as of this week again. Very good news. So, hey, Tony, welcome back.
Really nice to be here. Thanks.
All right. Well, this is an important juncture to be talking about stuff we talk about on this show, because there's a huge wave of censorship crashing down on us. As you know from personal experience, Tony, it's getting completely out of control. I can't even keep up with all the people who are being banned, shadow banned, silenced, run out of town on a rail, and all this stuff. And to me, that suggests that they may be purging the internet of critical voices in preparation for the long-awaited big Trump false flag, possibly to amp up the war in the Middle East. Who knows? What do you think, Tony?
Well, let's take into account that the internet these days is really the fundamental medium of civilization. It's pretty much that simple. We used to read books. We used to write out books. Then came the printing press. Then came electronic media, satellites and such, and then along came digital communications. And now the internet, which is the basis of our civilizational complex, is being changed, radically changed, put under monopoly control of bad elements, the worst elements with the greatest amount of power, who are abusing that power to acquire more power, to push out those who challenge orthodoxy, challenge official narratives of all sorts. And it's really serious.
It is. And I mean, by, you know, one day if we wake up in concentration camps and there's a world war going on, maybe it'll be a little late to say, why didn't we stand up against this censorship when we could? Well, speaking of censorship, one of the most highly censored topics here in the US of A, where democracy is our national civic fundamentalist religion, is the topic of vote scam, that is hacking voting machines to generate bogus counts and steal elections. And there is, of course, this new Michael Moore film, Fahrenheit 11-9. I don't know how much that gets into that, but we have an online conference on this topic coming up, and people can get tickets and watch it live here on nolizeradio.org.
And I notice one of the guests is Mark Crispin Miller, who keeps his university job and is a real expert on this subject of election fraud, and also on 9/11, and makes the connections, the larger connections between these various ways of undermining our civilization.
Well, I'd love to have Mark Crispin Miller jump on, you know, sometime as a guest commentator here on False Flag Weekly News. But on the other hand, maybe discretion is the better part of valor, because apparently this show is so dangerous that professors like you, Tony, when you make this a part of what you do, all hell breaks loose. They're terrified of you. Well, 11-9, of course, referring to the Trump election, which may or may not have been rigged, like we know the 2004 election was rigged. That's just one of many of these events happening on dates with an 11 and a 9. And of course, the mother of all false flags was on 9/11/2001. I just published a piece about that here in American Free Press, one of the last genuinely free newspapers that's still printed on dead trees. And in this article, I pointed out that the 9/11 truth movement no longer shies away from people who talk about Israel's role in 9/11 the way it used to.
Maybe so, but some elements of the progressive left, the so-called progressive left, configuration, I think, that Noam Chomsky has been the presiding dean of, and Chris Hedges is now the presiding dean, they won't talk about 9/11. So it...
More and more truthers
will talk about it, but those who should be concerned, you know, after all, the left experienced Gladio to discredit it. The left has seen, you know, as a history of being discredited through false flags. And the left is derelict by and large, because they won't deal with the nature of the oppression that came at us after 9/11. And that oppression isn't the oppression that is publicized in the mainstream of crazed Islamic maniacs trying to rule our world. That is not the real story of 9/11.
Absolutely not. Well, my article is more about the general awakening to the Israeli role in 9/11 within the 9/11 truth movement, and the awakening of people who hadn't been part of the movement before to that very issue, like Ron Unz and so on. So I do think that getting at who did it is an important part of investigating this or any crime. And I think that we are making some progress. But hey, Tony, did you get this last week on 9/11 itself? I don't think you guys reported this last week when you and Jeremy Roth-Cushell did that great special about the 9/11 anniversary. That actually on last Tuesday, September 11th, there was this Air India plane with like 350 or something people on board that nearly came plowing down into skyscrapers in New York. It lost all of its computerized flight controls, including the traffic collision and avoidance system. So we may have narrowly missed another 9/11 in New York. And I mean, call me a paranoid conspiracy theorist, but this seems like a really strange coincidence that this would happen over New York on Tuesday, September 11th.
Well, coincidences do happen.
Even if they can't be pronounced. Okay. Yeah. Well, maybe it's a coincidence, maybe not. Just like maybe it's a coincidence that Arnold Milshon, the number one Israeli nuclear smuggler, smuggling nuclear weapons from the United States to Israel, happened to produce this film, The Medusa Touch, about planes into buildings in New York years before it actually supposedly happened. Well, I think the script was played out in real life. Anyway, another 9/11 tragedy was, of course, the Chile coup of 1973. There's a book called Chile, the Other September 11th that goes into that. And I guess you have to watch RT to hear about it.
Well, the 9/11 in Chile in 1973 was really historic, and it set in motion a lot of developments. And it was the first real takeover by the neoliberal school. Interestingly, if you read Naomi Klein's Shock Doctrine, she has the history going back to the 1950s. There was a group of Chileans who came to the University of Chicago, where Milton Friedman became the kind of presiding dean over the so-called Chicago Boys, and learned this sort of neoliberal deregulation, get government out of the economy and leave it all to the corporations. That was developed at the University of Chicago, behind Milton Friedman as Hayek, who was basically tasked with taking down John Maynard Keynes, Keynesian economics, from its inception, which is government should intervene, spend more money, stimulate the economy, and this kind of thing. So the coup in Chile was about putting in place the dictator Pinochet, the army, and bringing in Milton Friedman and these Chicago Boys who had been studying since the 1950s. And this, to me, suggests that this planning, that these operations, this coup d'etat, think of how much planning, if it really was connected to things going on in the universities in the 1950s. And it does point to the significance of things going on at the in the universities, where things are allowed to start up and given the latitude and funding and resources to get
absolutely
going.
And the connection between this shock imposed on Chile that Naomi Klein describes in the Shock Doctrine and the other 9/11 on 2001 was that both of these were actually engineered shocks to the human nervous system. As Naomi Klein explains, this is based on CIA research with torturing people to shock them so much that you can totally rebuild their personalities from the ground up. Dr. Ewan Cameron did this for the CIA's MKUltra mind control program. So they learned that to radically affect people and change their outlook, you have to deliver a huge shock to their nervous system. And they did that to Chile in order to make it neoliberal economically. And they did that to the United States to take it on a forever war against Israel's enemies, double the military budget, and end constitutional liberties. And so, speaking of engineered shocks on September 11th, there's a third one. And that happened on September 11th, 2008. This is a great article by Matt Taibbi. It doesn't quite go all the way there. Matt never does. But it's pretty darn good anyway. It was on September 11th, 2008, I think it was right about the same time in the morning that 9/11 happened in 2001, that the blow to the financial system was delivered. that created this massive orchestrated crash through which the vampire squids of the world sucked out trillions of dollars of wealth from ordinary people and are still sitting on it. So I think we should remember that anniversary too.
When I was finishing the book, The Earth into Property, I was just finishing up as this financial crash was happening. And I thought, well, here's the culmination of my book, which is about colonization, decolonization, and capitalism. Capitalism is giving us a big spectacular event. And I started running into this word derivatives. And so to understand the crash, you have to understand derivatives. Mortgages was one part of it, but there's the whole deep state type of economics about who's going to build the pipeline, what regime is going to be in place. These lend themselves to derivative bets. Now, Matt Taibbi doesn't go the whole way. In fact, he has been a hitman on the 9/11 truth movement. His book, The Great Derangement, has a chapter devoted to ridiculing in sort of a Chomsky style.
That title is quite appropriate because Taibbi shows himself the victim of a great derangement when it comes to 9/11.
Yeah, so we have a bit of a history with Matt Taibbi, and he goes into Goldman Sachs. I would say the real ground zero of the derivatives issue was AIG, and that's where you should go for the deep state understanding of what really transpired on 2008, 2009.
And the bottom line here, Tony, is that these powerful entities that rule our world don't have our best interests at heart in any way, shape, or form. And right now, it looks like they could be getting ready to impose suffering on an unprecedented scale through a potential World War III that could start in and around Syria. We have some really worrisome things going on there. We have Israeli fighter jets shadowing a Russian plane in such a way as to get it shot down. It was basically an intentional act by Israel. And Russia, thus far, is speaking fairly softly, but they do have a pretty big stick.
Yeah, so this is an interesting development. So the Syrian armed forces shoot down a Russian jet. Supposedly, they are allies. But somehow the Israelis were involved in some kind of invasion of a particular post. So that was the reason for this mistaken taking out of a Russian airliner.
Well, the Israelis are essentially bombing the heck out of Syria because the Syrian government is an ally of the Axis of Resistance, which would include Iran, Hezbollah, and other forces in the region that would like to liberate the Middle East from outside aggression and imperialism. So that's what this war in Syria, of course, has really been all about. And the Israelis have been a major driving force behind that war, as well as a direct participant in bombing Syrian government targets, as well as its allies who were there in Syria at the request of the government. But right now we're at a crucial junction where Syria's about to get back the last major rebel stronghold of Idlib. And we've had expectations for all hell breaking loose now for weeks. So far, there's an uneasy truce, or at least a kind of a refraining from going all out happening there. And we have this news that the al-Nusra Front, which is al-Qaeda, which is 100% U.S. supported, try to figure that one out, there's 10,000 of those people there. I mean, they've basically been moved out, peacefully evacuated from each of these other strongholds that they had through Russian plans to try to minimize civilian casualties. Well, now we've got 10,000 of them left here in Idlib, and we've got them being moved over to a certain area of Idlib away from the civilians. I guess that's good, but this is all still balancing, precariously, and a little push like a false flag, another poison gas false flag could push the whole thing over the edge.
Yes, well, this Idlib story is really the cutting edge of the next round of history in Syria. And this multipolar world, the different alignments of power, that are coming into place to replace that moment where the United States figured there was a unilateral, that, you know, they had it all sewn up, that they had control of the world sewed up, but now that's not the case. And Syria is really at the center of this. So Idlib province has 3 million people. It's at the northern part of Syria, and it borders on Turkey. So Putin and Erdogan have gotten together and come up with a plan to demilitarize Idlib. So Turkey and Russia are making deals, which is a major development in history in its own right. Turkey being kind of pulled away from the US orbit into the Russian-Iranian orbit. And so this Idlib province, this demilitarized zone, sort of ends the vision that Assad is going to unify the whole of what had been Syria. It looks like there is going to be some kind of new jurisdiction, and it's a sort of trial run for this Iran, Russia, Turkey alliance. And so it will set the patterns for future situations and developments, and could be negotiations or wars in Syria.
And it's great that we have at least one person in Congress, not my favorite congressperson even, but somebody who occasionally will tell you the truth about something, Tulsi Gabbard, who's speaking out against the Trump administration's protection of Al-Qaeda in Syria. Tulsi Gabbard has consistently been asking this obvious question that nobody else in the media in the U.S. is allowed to ask, which is, why is the United States supporting Al-Qaeda? And worse than Al-Qaeda, this so-called ISIS or Daesh, this is the million-dollar question, and I'm glad that one person in Congress has the guts to ask it.
Well, Tulsi Gabbard is a name we should put in our memory. Cynthia McKinney isn't in Congress right now, but it seems that Tulsi Gabbard is as close as we have. And she is a really steadfast in speaking from time to time truth to power. And she lays it on the line in this brief statement in Congress. I mean, after all, to this day, isn't the interpretation of 9/11 that it was done by Al-Qaeda, and that Al-Qaeda was led by Osama bin Laden, and that these are the culprits of 9/11? So interestingly, Tulsi Gabbard sort of goes along with that story, with that legend, and says it's a disgrace that the U.S. government is assisting and arming and financing the people who did 9/11. Now, we know Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden didn't do 9/11, but it is an explosive message. And she says in this speech, for the president, who is also the commander-in-chief, to act as the protective big brother of Al-Qaeda and other jihadists must be condemned by every member of Congress. So there, it's putting it on the line for the U.S. government, for Donald Trump to be helping the commander-in-chief, the people who are said to have done 9/11, who were told in our schools, in our mainstream media, in our books, that Al-Qaeda did 9/11. And there is Donald Trump, who, you know, must know about 9/11, just going along with this illusion. And here is Tulsi Gabbard speaking truth to power to a certain extent. But of course, the next stage is saying, well, did Al-Qaeda, if Al-Qaeda didn't do 9/11, who did? And this is, of course, a big subject for us.
Well, of course, that's why the authorities have a problem with what she's doing, is that if you tell people they're being lied to this extent, right? I mean, we're supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria, then what else might they be lying about? And once you start uncovering one or two of these big lies, then the others start falling like dominoes. And I think that's the problem that is leading to all of this internet censorship, because the dominoes of truth are falling, and the powers that be find their power threatened. And so we're facing a monstrous new wave of censorship that we can hardly even keep up with here on False Flag Weekly News. But let's go over some of the big stories this week. Well, just here's me talking about censorship at the 9/11 Film Festival. That's posted at my website. And so in 10 minutes, talking about Bonnie Faulkner being scrubbed from KPFA Berkeley, the home of the free speech movement, an outrageous example, and on and on and on. Everything I get into 10 minutes. Well, let's see what we can get into 10 minutes here on False Flag Weekly News. Okay, next story.
Just before we get past Guns and Butter and Bonnie Faulkner's show, let me point out that Democracy Now, hosted by Amy Goodman, which famously won't go into 9/11, that show, and many other subjects, many other examples of false flag terrorism, that is a show that came out of Pacifica, and I think came out of KPFA, if I'm not mistaken. So the show you're advocating for, Guns and Butter, is in a way the non-Democracy Now. This is a Pacifica network coming up with something really valuable, really pioneering, really authoritative. Bonnie Faulkner is a very thoughtful, well-informed, deeply erudite person. And many people identify this with this show as a kind of a source of light and a beacon of honesty in a very corrupt realm of wall-to-wall fake news often.
Absolutely. Shout out to Bonnie Faulkner. Well, the next story is about censorship over at Amazon, which has been burning books, digitally burning books, for a couple of years now. It burned over 100 historical revisionist books after the big false flag where Michael Kadar, the Israeli agent, phoned in fake hoaxes and threats aimed at Jewish targets in the United States, which led to this big scare of resurgent anti-Semitism that was used to purge all of these books on Amazon. And now they're purging the 9/11 truth books. Well, not purging them, but they're shadow banning them. Shadow banning means slowing things down in a deniable way. And that's certainly what they seem to have done here to the new David Ray Griffin and Elizabeth Woodworth book, 9/11 Unmasked, which was totally available and should have been shipping on September 11th, but it kept reporting out of print, and then later they changed that to, well, in stock on September 30th. That was supposed to be in stock on September 11th, and Amazon is trying to make sure that it doesn't come out of the starting gate with a bang.
Well, let's be clear about what this book is. This book is kind of coming out in a belated way. It is the Toronto hearings, the 10th anniversary of 9/11, brought together a number of major figures, people who were considered to be the most credible figures of the 9/11 truth movement. Certainly Graham McQueen, Professor McQueen, was part of that, and there were many other witnesses as well. So David Ray Griffin, who is often referred to as the Dean of 9/11 Studies, one of the big names, and his sidekick helps him with editing and such, Elizabeth Woodworth, who is a former librarian, I think, at either Vancouver or Victoria Library System, you know, a very precise person and a very conservative in her interpretations, yet outward looking and, you know, working closely with David Ray Griffin. This is what this book, 9/11 Unmasked, gives the results, the outcome of the Toronto hearings. And so here is Edward Curtin, got a certain amount of attention for this book, reviewed this book. The review went here and there, but now it seems that there are these obstacles being put in the way of this book being distributed and all kinds of dubious, questionable stories about why it's not getting out.
Well, 9/11 is still the big kahuna. This is what the censorship ultimately fears the most, because once this is permanently blown wide open, that's the end for the forces that did it, which means we're going to be living in a whole new world. And another case of pushback against truth happened this week as The Spectator, which is Britain's most respectable conservative publication, went after Ron Unz. You know, I got to have lunch with Ron in the San Francisco Bay Area while I was in town for the 9/11 Truth Film Festival. And he's a wonderful guy. He's a pretty serious thinker. He doesn't go off half-cocked at all. It took him years and years and years to finally decide to wade into these controversial issues of the type that we deal with here on False Flag Weekly News. And he, you know, he reads a lot of books before he talks about these things. Yet The Spectator tries to make him out as crazy and reckless. He's gone too far, but they can't bring themselves to really say that, because if you read his stuff, you can see that this guy is thinking deliberately and slowly and rigorously and clearly. And even here in this hit piece, the author, Ben Sixsmith, says, quote, "There is no denying that Unz bases his arguments on interesting information." Well, yeah. So let's read it. Let's link to it. Meanwhile, the same author, Ben Sixsmith, unleashes a vicious attack on me, blaming me for Ron Unz becoming a truther. He says that the suspicion that Unz's contrarian instincts were growing out of control was exacerbated when he published an article by the radical Muslim conspiracy theorist and fantasizer about the deaths of journalists, Kevin Barrett, which somehow worked Holocaust denial into an analysis of a theology book. Well, yeah, that was my first article at Unz, a review of David Gray Griffin's book, God Exists But God Does Not. And I noticed that Ben Sixsmith did not link my review because his characterization of it is so blatantly slanderous, so over the top, that anybody who actually read the review would see that Ben Sixsmith is a liar and a slanderer.
Well, indeed, this story is partly about you, Kevin Barrett. And sometimes it could be said that it is all about you. But in any case, this article about Ron Unz is mostly about this very interesting new voice to the 9/11 truth movement. And he outlines, and we discussed this in some detail, Jeremy and I, last week. He goes through, you know, several years of history, recounting his gradual questioning of the official story of 9/11. And then he ends with going into, it was an absurdity to deal with this 9/11 as an inside job, that somehow the generals did it or some component of the U.S. military did it. We've got to deal with the fact that people connected to the concept of greater Israel and an expansionary Israel first partisans, seem to have had a major role, especially the people involved in the project for the new American century. Alan Zabrowski is a formidable person who's addressed all of this. He goes through all of that history. And of course, by doing so, he brings on the ire of some of his conservative colleagues. But in fact, they do treat him rather with kid gloves, unlike they might treat you, for instance, Kevin.
Interesting, yeah, because of course Ron has gone much further than I have down the path of essentially denying that the official account of what happened to Jews and other minorities who were persecuted and incarcerated by the Nazis during World War II is not exactly correct. I just call for free and independent inquiry, and I'll tell you what I've understood based on my preliminary investigations. Ron actually went and read 20 books on the subject and came to the conclusion that the revisionists are almost certainly right. So it's weird.
Well, revisionists, it's not one thing that, you know, they all agree on, so you can say they're right. They're wrong. It's a vastly complex array of...
Well, we can sort of hold up the two positions, you know, But let's do that on a different show. In any case, I think my characterization in broad brushstrokes is correct, that Ron's piece does essentially arrive at the conclusion that, broadly speaking, the responsible World War II so-called Holocaust revisionists are probably correct based on his reading of 20 books and his knowledge of the issue. In any case, let's move on to another influential American who's being pilloried by the forces of repression. And that's Alex Jones. This is a really interesting interview that Alex did with this guy, this entrepreneurial YouTube guy. I can't remember his name, somebody I'd never heard of before.
Patrick Brett David.
Thank you. Wow, I mean, I couldn't get to the end of this, but I watched more than half of it. And I think the key quote that I pulled out of this at the 1 hour and 10 minute mark was Alex saying, "They're not trying to ban me because they think I'm full of horse manure. They're trying to ban me because I've got their number." Well, yeah, I think you're right, actually. I think that Alex is banned because he's dangerous, not because he's of the things he's doing that are dubious.
Well, this is a very rotund Alex Jones. He, you know, seems to change shape from time to time. But in any case,
he's a shapeshifter.
Sort of like Elvis, I see Alex Jones as a core figure in Americana, in the category of the level of maybe Elvis, Marilyn Monroe, Michael Jackson. Somehow these figures occasionally come along and become so intertwined in the sort of cultural phenomena that is the United States. And Alex Jones as he tells it, the Democrats around Hillary Clinton sort of perceive that he created the platform or the constituency or the worldview onto which Donald Trump then stepped and did become president of the United States by sort of going into that milieu and into that cultural ethos that had been created through, you know, Alex Jones.
Mm-hmm. And there's some
very intelligent man. And it was seeing him talk in 2006 when he was introducing like Webster Tarpley and Bob Bowman and, you know, others. I mean, he has a capability to be kind of moderate and academic in his tone, but he wasn't doing this with Bette David. Bette David really did challenge him. Bette David is an Iranian. His thing is entrepreneurship, as he described it. And he kept calling on him, for instance, well, who did 9/11? Who did 9/11? And Jones equivocated and kind of tried to avoid it and say, well, I don't really know. I don't really know. But then he did say, elements of the U.S. government and elements of Israel. He did say that mm-hmm. in this interview.
All right. Right on, Alex Jones. He may have backed off on some of his claims about Sandy Hook, but he's not really backing off on 9/11. And I respect that. And I do think that it's true that he has had an effect on the Trump revolution for good and ill, but probably a little bit more for good, I suppose. He certainly stands towers above those idiots on Fox News and Breitbart.
We really need to be as clear and pointed as we can in pointing at Donald Trump and saying, you know, bro, you are a 9/11 truther, and you mm-hmm. have an idea of what really happened and who did it and who didn't do it. And by going to Shanksville and saying, oh, let's celebrate the heroes like he did on 9/11, this is an insult to us. And so Donald Trump is insulting his major constituency, his core vote. And that is a very dangerous thing for a politician to do. But let's become vocal on this subject, truthers.
Well, that's why I participated in Robert David Steele's series of 27 letters to Trump about 9/11, hoping that it would have some effect. It didn't work this year. Maybe it planted some seeds. Who knows? Well, we have to pick up the pace a little bit here, Tony. We're just, check my stopwatch, we have to try to get to your stories about Canada. So let's go for it here. Another influential American being censored these days is Michael Hoffman, one of our great revisionist historians, not just Holocaust revisionist, but revisionist on many issues. And now Amazon is banning his books. Hoffman's books, unlike Alex Jones's discourses, are very calm, without any real anger or hatred or emotion. They're just, this is historiography. How can Amazon be banning these calm history books that are well documented, written in polite academic tones? This is outrageous.
Which ones have you read of his?
Hoffman's, I've read, let's see, Judaism, Strange Gods, which is one of the ones that they banned. I've read the Renaissance Church, or Usury, his book on usury, his book on the Renaissance Church of Rome, and so on and so forth, on the sort of Freemasonic the people practicing magic, infiltrating the church. So I've read at least three of his books, possibly more, and they're really good. You should read them.
I ordered from Amazon in the days when it wasn't a book burning operation. a book about the Toronto trials of Ernst Zundel in the mid to late 1980s. And it's the only book on the Toronto trials. And I grew up in Toronto and I was aware of those trials taking place. And, you know, my main thing in the academy, my major field in my PhD work was Canadian history. And so I look at these trials that took place in Toronto of Ernst Zundel involving Doug Christie and David Irving and Hildebrand and, you know, many of the key figures.
Was Michael Hoffman involved in that?
Hoffman was there and he wrote the book on the Toronto trials.
Oh, God, that's right. That's right.
I see those Toronto trials. This is Canadian history. And, you know, Ernst Zundel was a Canadian as well as a German. And so in terms of wanting to know about this particular chapter as a expert in the field of Canadian history, I could say, I think it's quite important that for a Canadian historian to go into this particular subject that Michael Hoffman writes about. And what's his book on usury? What's that all about?
Well, I think it's called something like Usury in Christendom. And so, you know, it is not pointing the finger at Jews in any way, shape, or form. It's the opposite. It's basically acquitting Jews of the charge of being the main force behind usury. It's saying that the Catholic Church got influenced and infiltrated by usurers. It's not even the Protestants. I mean, a lot of people blame the Jews, or then they blame the Jews plus the Protestants. Traditionalist Catholics often say that. But Hoffman's book shows that the Catholic Church itself was a hotbed of usury. So, you know, anybody who's worried about so-called anti-Semitism should be promoting that book, not banning it. But these people are such idiots. Anybody who's going anywhere that could bring suppressed truth to light, I suppose, is a threat to their control of the public mind. But we do have to move on, Tony.
I'm wary of calling people idiots. But Michael E. Jones would tell us the Protestant Reformation was a big revolution having to do with usury. Anyway,
I know he would. And Hoffman would tell you something different. And so Jones, you can see why the so-called, you know, crusaders against anti-Semitism would have a problem with Jones. But they shouldn't have a problem with Hoffman at all. They should be celebrating him. But they're OK. I'm not going to call them stupid again. I'll try to come up with a different adjective. Anyway, moving on to Marine Le Pen. Marine Le Pen over in France. They're not just calling her stupid, they're calling her crazy. She's being prosecuted for tweeting some pictures, some bloody gruesome pictures of ISIS victims. And so the court has ordered her to have a psychiatric evaluation. So now they're going to be not only marginalizing and banning dissidents, but they're going to be putting us in mental hospitals.
Well, this is a serious initiative to do that. And of course, it's an effort to discredit her. And of course, you know, then when some report comes out and then, you know, what's the verdict going to be? I learned about this phenomena with respect to Bruce Clark, who's splitting this guy hired as their lawyer to deal with the question issue that British Columbia, the Aboriginal title remains in place. The laws of the British Empire weren't followed in terms of getting some kind of transaction in a treaty from Indigenous peoples. And the lawyer who was arguing this in court was sent for a mental examination. And Ramsey Clark looked at this after the fact, who was splitting this guy's lawyer, and said that judge knew what he was doing. He was discrediting that lawyer and trying to discredit this true argument that, in fact, that is the situation with the lands of British Columbia, and treaty negotiations are taking place to this day. So Bruce Clark, I saw him go through it, and he bragged that he could prove that he's mentally sane, that he has a certificate.
Well, people shouldn't have to try and prove that just because they have whatever their political opinions are. I don't agree with Marine Le Pen on a lot of things, probably most things, but this is an outrage. Well, moving on to another guy that they're probably going to try to lock up, but currently they're just locking him out of Facebook. Dick Eastman, a populist economist, 9/11 truther, and so on. He's been banned. They banned him after he posted something about, is Hitler to be blamed for World War II? So apparently World War II is a sensitive topic.
Well, and I believe he was also ran into obstructions and banning because he was telling the story of Patrick Little, who is running for a Senate seat, and Patrick Little going against Feinstone in the, what do they call it, the preliminaries.
Feinstein.
Feinstein.
Yeah.
Feinstein. She's got a Stein. That's fine. So in any case, Patrick Little's position is, you know, U.S. should not be supporting wars for Israel. U.S. should put America first, not Israel first. Donald Trump, put America first. Don't put Israel first. You know, this is a fairly clear message. A lot of Americans apparently take to it. It's seen as a very threatening message. So Dick Eastman has been telling us about the obstructions he's been facing, not only on Facebook, but on Gmail. Which is,
and they're also
Google,
going after they're going after professors, YouTube. Tony. I mean, this is going to come to as news to you, Tony. But they're going after professors too. The latest is John Chaney Lippold, who's a digital studies professor at the University of Michigan. He refused to do a letter of recommendation for somebody who wanted to go study in Israel, and the local Zionists are in an uproar. Give us the short version, Tony, because we're 2/3 of the way through the show and halfway through the stories.
Well, there is an association called the Association of American Studies, a big academic association, which John Chaney Lippold is part of. And they have voted and are executing their plan to do boycott, divestment, and sanction. So this letter writing exercise fell under the auspices of this vote of the association, the academic association that Professor Cheney Lippold is part of. And so he was, in his mind, following along with his membership, what is required of members of this organization. And of course, right. It was picked up by Israel lobby organizations, and the University of Michigan was made to feel embarrassed. And of course, it could be argued that, look, a student has a right to want to go and study wherever they want. And who is a professor to be deciding, no, I'll write a letter to this university, but not to that university. There is a kind of argument that does have, you know, hold some water in this instance, I would say. But it seems like John Cheney Lippold is standing his ground, and we'll see how the powers that be deal with it.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think one has a right to recommend anyone one wants or to turn down anyone one wants, essentially for any reason. And especially, you know, if somebody wants to go to Africa with the CIA to torture people to extract more diamonds,
well,
or something.
Hey, wait a minute.
I'm not going to write them a recommendation. Likewise, if somebody wants to go to Israel and it's not to fight against the genocide there, but to participate in the genocide, obviously I'm not going to write them a letter of recommendation, except maybe to a war crimes tribunal. But we do have to move faster, Tony. So here we go. Next one, Rutgers University, Kenneth Marcus, the civil rights guy at Rutgers, is reopening a case from 2011 charging that some Palestinians tried to charge money for some students but not others at one of their events. Wow, if that's the worst that the pro-Palestinian students do, I'm flabbergasted.
Let's keep moving.
Okay, keep moving. The Russian Duma, even Russia is criminalizing fake news. This is part of a pushback against American propaganda. Here in America, all we hear about is Russian propaganda, but apparently Russia is facing the same thing, and perhaps even more so.
Oh my goodness. You mean Russia has corrupt elites who try to tweak the story to their advantage? I'm shocked.
Indeed. Okay. No more fake news in Russia now. They're going to be thrown in prison if they even try for up to 1 year. Moving on to Canadian software censoring people. Tony, you should be ashamed of yourself. You Canadians are selling censorship software. Does this surprise you?
No, not at all. This is a story about a company in the Waterloo area called NetSweeper. And NetSweeper has been working to make software that enables companies and countries to censor the internet. And of course, in the Gulf countries allied with Saudi Arabia, a lot of this goes on. They get the NetSweeper software. So Canada comes through as one of the sources of software to do this censorship, which is one of our main themes today.
And so these Western high-tech companies that are censoring us right here in the West, the land of freedom and opportunity, are helping even more repressive governments censor people overseas. Another example is Google helping the Chinese block the Uyghur Muslims, who apparently are being locked in concentration camps in great numbers. Whether it's as great as is claimed, I don't know. But Google should be ashamed of itself for many reasons, including this.
Well, this doesn't make Google look very good. Remember, there was a day when Google was kind of a hero and sort of liberating the internet.
Yeah, their motto was "Don't be evil."
And the ranking of sites when you Googled something all had to do with who was getting the most, what article was getting the most hits, and that in itself was very important intelligence to know what article on what subject was, you know, most popular. Now we don't get that. Now we get custom-made outcomes to our searches that supposedly know our likes and whatnot. But Google is working with the Chinese and helping the Chinese do censorship of the internet of dissidents and this Uyghur Muslim group in Xinjiang province, a huge part of China. You know, they're specifically targeting this group. I call it like the Palestinization, like the way Israel is treating Palestinians, China is kind of treating Uyghurs. And so this clampdown on dissenting voices, especially if those dissenting voices are promoting an Islamic agenda. Obviously, this is a big factor in our world today, and China is very much involved, and Google itself is exposed. The good people in Palo Alto, you know, who had this wonderful image of this core company in their community, that no longer applies.
Of course, it wouldn't surprise me if Google was also cooperating with the CIA in an attempt to stir up the most radically nationalistic segment of the Uyghur population to create trouble for the Chinese as well, because they not only will do evil for one group, they'll probably do evil for the opposing group as well. But let's move on to Heil Trump news. Heil Trump. That's right. Donald Trump is sending a text message to every American. I guess he just did. I missed it, though. I don't have a cell phone. And there's no way to opt out. This is a presidential emergency management FEMA tweet. I don't even like these stupid platforms, but I guess we all have to use them anyway. If there's a big Trump false flag, we're all going to get a tweet telling us I am now the dictator and we are at war.
Well, if you watch this particular video, it nowhere says that Donald Trump is going to personally address every American through Twitter, but it's called apparently a presidential address. So we'd have to see the tweet to see to what extent, you know, was Donald Trump just saying, hey, vote for me next election, or I doubt if it was that obvious. But Donald Trump has a reputation for sort of running the White House off his Twitter account. And Twitter does enable Donald Trump to speak directly, to bypass all his handlers and the people who filter, you know, messages coming out of the White House and whatnot.
And that's why they hate him so much. I just read this. I'm reviewing it for the Crescent magazine. And boy, there has been a containment operation directed around Trump.
Well, we'll look forward to hearing a fuller account of this, Kevin.
Okay. Well, how about Michael Moore's take on Trump? Obviously, these guys, Bob Woodward with his new book, Fear, and Michael Moore. I mean, these guys are part of, I think, an attempt to either contain Trump or get rid of him. And I think the establishment wants to get rid of him for all the wrong reasons, that Trump is basically an instinctive isolationist, quote unquote, who wants to pull American military forces out of everywhere. He wants to pull out of Korea. He wants to disband NATO. He wants to pull out of Iraq and Syria, and he wants to pull out of Afghanistan. That is all made very, very clear in this book. And the people who've stopped him from doing that are basically admitting that they are committing treason. So it's quite interesting. Anyway, Michael Moore probably hates Trump for some of the right reasons too.
Okay, Michael Moore and Trump. Let's move on.
Okay, well, I'm looking forward to seeing that, because I don't know whether Michael Moore is going to get into the election theft stuff or not. How about the wealthy Jewish GOP donors fleeing Trump's sinking ship? We learned that from Richard Silverstein, a really good source. I love reading his stuff. So we have Seth Klarman, the biggest GOP donor from Ohio, and from New England, and Leslie Wexner, the biggest one from Ohio, who are now pulling out of the Trump train.
So big news. Some big money supports the Democratic Party. Some more of the big money supports the Republican Party. Sheldon Adelson's support of that is sort of legendary. Okay.
And these guys are Republicans.
People have lots of money, and they get to call the shots about what goes down in our politics. Surprise, surprise.
Right. Well, I would keep an eye on the wealthy Jewish GOP donors, because, I mean, aren't they the ones that privatized the World Trade Center before 9/11? As I recall, the head of the Port Authority was also the number one Republican donor nationwide, and he did happen to be Jewish and a fervent Zionist. He was, you know, anyway, let's move on. We got very little time left here. How about Paul Manafort? It turns out he's linked to the guys who stole Ohio for George W. Bush in 2004, including Mike Connell, who went down in a very suspicious plane crash just days after he had said he was going to testify against Karl Rove. And I believe Rove issued him some kind of threat. And the next thing you know, Connell's plane goes down. Well, Manafort was working with Connell on his Steal Elections for Republicans project, and they also stole elections, apparently, for Yanukovych over in Ukraine. So another interesting spin on this Trump-Russiagate thing that you're never going to hear about in the mainstream.
I looked into election fraud fairly deeply when I was looking at an election Stephen Harper prevailed in Canada, and I was getting into the deeper story in the United States. And this Mike Connell death just before he was going to give evidence dealing with Karl Rove, Mike Connell was a key player in the tweaking of the voting machines and the reconfiguration of the outcome through the capacity to make these digital voting machines produce the outcome that the biggest donor or the owner of the voting machines wants. Mike Connell was also involved in the fixing of elections in Ukraine to produce Viktor Yanukovych. There was a lot of fraud around that election. Chicanery and violence as well. So it's interesting to read, the Ohio election on the one hand, the Ukrainian election on the other hand, and to find the same people are involved with the same strategies, and this is the world we live in.
It is. And so we see coups d'etat and counter coups going on all the time, 9/11, of course, being one of them. In fact, all three 9/11s were coups in a sense. And of course, here we have trying to overthrow the government of Venezuela. This is the kind of thing that Alex Jones will never tell you about. He's actually probably on the side of the coup plotters because he hates communism and he thinks those Venezuelans are a bunch of commies. I don't see things that way myself. And I'm not happy with the Trump people trying to overthrow Venezuelan socialism.
Yes, and Venezuelan socialism goes back to Hugo Chavez. Hugo Chavez was very much enraptured with the Cuban Revolution and was good friends with Fidel Castro. He fended off U.S.-backed coups to stay in power. He died probably prematurely. We could question what happened to Hugo Chavez, who was a real populist, who is much beloved by the poor and much hated by the those in the higher end, many of those in the higher end.
Tony, we don't have to speculate about what happened to Chavez, do we really? I mean, John Perkins describes how they kill off anybody south of the border, any leader that doesn't take their hand fistful of cash. So, I mean, obviously he got a cancer weapon.
Well, and now the government, which still persists, what's his name, Maduro? Maduro, they're destabilizing that government, the U.S. deep state people in many ways and making that country increasingly difficult to govern, I would say, and want to get Venezuela, a big oil-producing country, back into the what they used to call the Washington Consensus.
Right. And I think it's pathetic that otherwise, people who do good work in some ways critiquing the deep state, like Alex Jones and Mike Adams of Natural News, people who are getting a lot of the censorship pushback, will go along with an attempt to overthrow the government of Venezuela just because they think that the leaders there are socialists. I mean, that's a really major mistake by those guys. Anyway, moving on to Canada, Tony, your home ground, we have Doug Ford, the Ontario premier. Is he a wannabe Trump or is he just a Trump fanboy?
No, I would say he's most significant in the fact that he's the brother of Rob Ford. And Rob Ford, he seemed to be doing crystal meth or coke or, he got sort of exposed and he was the butt of a lot of jokes on American late night TV. Remember Rob Ford, the mayor of Toronto. So his brother, people might not be aware, actually won a majority government of the province of Ontario. I'm from the province of Ontario. The province of Ontario is way bigger than Texas. It's a huge jurisdiction.
Texas? Tony, nothing's bigger than Texas.
This city called Toronto that is a large...
I think I heard of that place once.
Yeah, the overall... Canadian population, and oftentimes you have in provinces or states cities which have more people than the rest of the jurisdiction combined. So here's Doug Ford, Rob Ford's brother, taking the government, sort of a populist figure like his brother, going down to Washington. Of course, there's negotiations taking place concerning trade between Canada, U.S., and Mexico, NAFTA. And so Doug Ford is cozying up to what should be similar ideological people around Trump. Of course, you know, who is really around Trump and what are the real ideologies? You say there might be disparity. But anyway, there's Doug Ford in Washington, in a sense, representing Canada in this trade deal, which shouldn't be. It's a national responsibility to do, you know, international treaties. And then the next story is Ford has changed, you know, has passed a new law to cut the municipal government of Toronto, the councilman, in half, from 47 to 25. It might seem like a small deal, but it's, of course, throwing the election into chaos. The election is for October 22. And it gets us into Canadian constitutional politics. And so
let's
there's
not go
a lot,
too deep into that.
There's a lot of issues around the fact that the so-called notwithstanding clause was going to be invoked. So Canada got this new constitution with a Charter of Rights and Freedoms in 1982. And so we have all these glowing statements about freedom of expression and freedom of this and freedom of that that belongs to
individuals. Academic freedom.
Academic freedom. But then there are these contradictory elements of this charter that say, well, these things have to be proven to be reasonable in a free and democratic society, or governments can opt out as long as they say they opt out. So this is a basically, you know, the right wing saying, we don't want judge-made law. People elect their officials, parliament, legislatures, they should have supremacy, they should have the power. And judges come along and interpret the Charter of Rights and Freedoms to say, saying this changing of the civic government of the municipality of Toronto. And a municipality is not a sovereign. A province is a sovereign. Province set up a municipality. The province of Ontario sets up Toronto and thus can change the municipal government of Toronto. So anyway, this is an introduction. We learn your politics, learn a bit about our politics in Canada. We do share a continent after all, and we have the biggest part of it in Canada. So this is a little flash of what's going on in Canada these days.
Oh, Canada. Yes. All right. Moving back back to Earth from Canada, how about this new El Jazeera?
Whoa, we
only have 2 minutes.
Imperialist.
Yeah. We all know that Israel is far more important than Canada. It gets vastly more news. And of course, it's all spun in the favor of that settler regime. But anyway, we learn a little more from this censored Al Jazeera documentary that apparently Al Jazeera pulled and refused to broadcast after all sorts of Zionist pressure. Essentially, the Zionists said, Saudi Arabia is going to invade you and destroy your country and kill and torture you if you broadcast this. And so they didn't. But it's slowly leaking out anyway.
Yeah, this is kind of another Canadian story because Real News, although it's based in Baltimore, it's created by Canadian people. Paul Jay, who bailed from the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, he's the sort of dominant figure. And here is a broadcast dealing with this Al Jazeera documentary. Al Jazeera is in Qatar, where there's a big U.S. air base, but Qatar is changing its orientation more towards Iran and is much in the news. And so there's some speculation that Qatar is doing a delicate balancing act and taking this show and not showing this documentary, this expose on the Israel lobby, primarily in the United States. That this has to do with you know, geopolitics in the Gulf region. But here is Ali Abu Nima and Max Blumenthal talking about elements of this documentary, this Al Jazeera documentary on the Israel lobby, emphasizing, for instance, Canary Mission and the exposure in this film that a certain
Adam Milstein
is the funder. This is particularly interesting to me because I am smeared.
He's a criminal. He's a kosher Nostra criminal who's done time in federal prison for tax evasion, just like Jared Kushner's dad.
Yeah, and here is a Canadian show pointing at the Canary Mission site, and I'm a Canadian, and I'm smeared, and it's a blacklisting site. The nature of the site is to try to destroy people's careers and reputations for being somewhat open and empathetic to the Palestinian side of things in discussing the Middle East. And I'm kind of wish that it's always depicted that it's only U.S. people on this Canary Mission site. No, there's Canadians, and I wish some Canadians who are looking at this story would notice that I'm there and that my career and has indeed been subjected to some pretty hard-hitting treatment at the University of Lethbridge. But there are other facets of this report, little bits coming out about this Al Jazeera documentary that is still under wraps. And that's the story here.
Well, Tony, Ali Abu Nira and Max Blumenthal would never work in this town again if they so much as breathed a word of your name. You're just that dangerous, I guess.
They certainly don't want to talk about 9/11,
ingredient
for Islamophobia, which they claim to be so much against.
We are not going to talk about 9/11 here. We're going to talk about how to steal a Tesla. That's right. You can hack and steal a Tesla Model S very easily. It takes exactly 2 seconds, as demonstrated at the Embedded Systems Conference in Amsterdam. We don't need to talk anymore about that, though, so let's move on.
How did this news make it into False Flag?
Alan, our producer, snuck this in. Okay. I guess Alan always just wanted to hotwire and steal a Model S. But moving on to Brett Kavanaugh. The Brett Kavanaugh nomination is all the headlines, blah, blah, blah. We haven't even mentioned it until now. But there's one thing worth mentioning is that Kavanaugh apparently was part of the cover-up of the Vince Foster murder under the Clintons. For more information about this, tune in tonight to my live radio show. That's right. It's broadcast on revolution.radio at 8 p.m. Eastern time. So that's going to be with DC Dave. And we're going to expose all of the real dirt about Brett Kavanaugh that you'll never hear about in the mainstream media. But finally, Tony, and our most important story of all is that Donald Trump may or may not be building a wall across the Sahara Desert. you can't make this stuff up. But you got to love Donald Trump in certain respects. Maybe he really will end the empire, whether through inadvertence and clumsiness and ineptitude or through design. But I suppose building a wall across the Sahara would be an internal monument like the Great Wall of China. This would be visible from outer space, and it would be even better than what Trump's trying to do on our southern border. So first, though, we got to build that wall to keep out the Canadians so they stop talking about their constitutional politics.
Well, Donald Trump came to power saying, hey, why not be friends with the Russians? And obviously he looked to Putin as a kind of example of a politician who'd acquired a lot of concentrated power and kind of likes that, and I think would like to replicate that model himself. But what would be wrong with being friends with the Russians?
I don't know. But in any case, we're going to have to leave it there because this is the end of our False Flag Weekly News broadcast for this week. I don't think I'll be back next week. I'm undergoing a very important mission, an international travel excursion, which you'll be hearing about more if you tune in to truthjihad.com. And so, Tony, you may be back here, or we may have Jeremy Rothkuschel. We may have others. So it's all a big mystery, but the show will go on. There will be a False Flag Weekly News next week, God willing. So until then, have a great week.
Bon
voyage. Thank you to our donors and sponsors and viewers.
Bon voyage, cher ami.